Okay, just one more turn of the wrench, and this satellite is fixed. Oh my god, I'm cut off from our space shuttle. I'm dangling in space 391 miles from Earth, and I'm gonna die. I'm gonna die.
You're gonna be fine. We'll figure a way out of this. But first, you have to calm down.
Okay. I'll try.
Just focus on all the reasons you have for getting back to Earth alive.
Like what?
I don't know. Let's see. The government is shut down. Miley Cyrus and Sinead O'Connor are having this weird feud. Breaking Bad is over. There's this really terrible movie with Ben Affleck and Justin Timberlake.
Look, just cut my cable loose.
You sure?
Yeah, it's actually kind of nice and quiet up here. But first, let me tell you that today on The Nose, we'll talk about Miley, Sinead, the shutdown, and how it all relates to our ideas about beauty. So you may actually want to join me up here in airless space. And now he's refusing to work until they turn the panda cam back on. Colin McEnroe.
If I don't have my panda cam, I'm not doing nothing. All right, so it's time for The Nose today. I'm making his debut on The Nose, Heath Folley from the Yankee Policy Institute. On the other side, we have Rand Cooper, writer, critic, author, various other things involving putting words on paper. And from Trinity College, we have Professor Irene Papoulos. That's here, who is here with us. We have, I don't know, I think we have sort of a thread here. I think we have a through line. I think we have sort of a bunch of things we want to talk about. As we go along here, you may want to talk about them with us too. So try to remember this number when you are seized with the urge to talk to us. It's 860-275-7266. That's 860-275-7266. We're going to start with a kind of a conversation where the common thread, I think, is sort of the notion of beauty and when it's appropriate to think about beauty and when it isn't. And we're going to start that with a very odd exchange that took place between Carol Costello, who is an anchor at CNN, and a Republican congressman from Indiana. Here they are.
Losing their job. Americans would say fight that fight separate from the federal budget. Don't partially shut down the government. Don't make things worse by fighting the same fight over and over. Right, we're going in circles, right. That's what you guys are doing.
No, you're part of the problem. The media is part of the problem as well.
Oh, come on. That's so easy. That's
Carol,
so easy.
Carol, you're beautiful, but you have to be honest as well.
Okay, I think we should leave it here. Thank you so much for joining me, Congressman Todd Rokita.
Okay, so that was Congressman Rokita. Heath Folley, you saw the longer clip. I don't know. What did you make of that? I mean, I don't know. Is that okay to say to Carol Costello?
Well, I think that there's this I think it's a meme that is often thought of as being just on the political right, but it's it really transcends our entire culture that news anchors are just news readers, and mm-hmm. so they're pretty faces. They don't have any thoughts or intelligence of their own, and so I think what the congressman is getting at is being kind of dismissive, is being very dismissive, and saying, "Well, oh, you're just a newsreader." When I think that's it certainly does short shrift to the conversation, and isn't it's an ad hominem attack instead of substantive. So
I wasn't 100% sure that that's what he was saying. What did you think he was saying?
I was thinking he was saying, I want to get away from the subject, the thing that you're criticizing me for, right? So I'll just say, oh, you're beautiful, but come on, you're wrong.
Yeah.
Next subject. And also, I noted earlier in the conversation, he said something like, well, I could see he was talking about children. I don't know whether you have children, and clearly you're too young to have grandchildren. And she said, thank you, mm-hmm. And so I thought, wow, all right. So in a way, she was giving him permission to say she was beautiful later in the conversation. And on some level, why would you say thank you because someone said you were too young to have grandchildren,
Well, I think we know why.
But, how old is she? I don't know.
Like, but, I mean, it's sort of you're youthful looking. You don't look – he's really probably saying you don't look your age or something along those lines.
Right, but you don't look your age, but therefore you do look your age because I am imagining what your age is by looking at you, right? It's just always such an odd compliment. And also just to think someone's complimenting you because they're telling you you look young. Right, it completely diverts. She was trying to get him to say something logical or to answer her question about the shutdown, and he didn't want to. So it's always easy to change directions that way. I mean, I think probably every woman listening to this has been in that position with a man at one point in their lives, probably, where that sort of appeal to the how she looks is a way to stop talking about whatever it is.
That was very well summed up. Rand, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this clip, but give us your take.
Well, I haven't seen the longer clip. I just heard what you played. But I was struck by there was a lack of tension or animus or animosity in it. It seemed very low-key, almost like either they both had run out, they'd run into a dead end in something that was scripted, and then there was almost this sense of relief or relaxation. Like, there's just this silence, and then suddenly, here's this remark. It didn't seem to create much offense. It didn't have any of the sort of the theatrics or the tonal tensions that would go with something that's adversarial. So I found it sort of tonally surprising and strange.
That's how I took it too, Colin. I think he was making a really bad attempt at being folksy. I don't think he was trying to be offensive, but he was.
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly came across as reducing her down to that. My interpretation of it was slightly different, which is that, first of all, I actually do think Carol Costello is a very attractive woman, and I was trying to put myself in his shoes, and I was sort of thinking that his mind probably was, as men's minds tend to do, working on a couple of tracks there. One of them is he was probably legitimately thinking, she really is a very attractive woman, And meanwhile, he's having this quote-unquote interview with her, but it's not really an interview if you listen to the longer version of it. It doesn't resemble an interview at all. They're interrupting each other there, and they're both a little bit culpable there, too. I mean, neither one of them is participating in anything close to an interview format. And yeah, then every once in a while he tries to kind of let the air out of it a little bit by telling her she doesn't look her age or, that she's beautiful. But I think in a way he was also trying to, I think for him, that was the elephant in the room, as
right.
it were. That he was really having this bad time with her conversationally, sort of, but he really thought she was a knockout, as guys used to sometimes say. And he just finally just wanted to say it.
Yeah, in that way, it did not seem tactical. It seemed like the air had run out of the things they were supposed to be talking about, and this other track, as you imply, that was there all the time, just sort of, he said what he'd been thinking about.
Just unbelievable to excuse that, though. I mean, sometimes you find people attractive and you think about it, but is that appropriate in an interview on CNN?
Oh no, I don't think it's appropriate at all. I wasn't excusing it. I was just sort of saying I think that's what was happening.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
How old
right.
is this? How old is the news person?
She's maybe Irish. Early 40s. Okay. I don't know. Yeah. I didn't really see her up close.
Somebody Google her. all right, we're going to actually jump from there. We have to keep moving here. We have a lot of topics we're going to cover here, but we think, at least I think, they might all be linked. I think you can jump from there to this strange feud that's going on between Sinead O'Connor, an Irish singer-songwriter, and who is in her 40s. We do know that. And Miley Cyrus, who is not. And for those of you who didn't follow it this week, it got very complicated. It started with an open letter from Sinead O'Connor to the younger star, telling her basically not to flaunt her body. Just because record executives wanted to do it. She sort of, you don't have to get naked. You don't have to lick a sledgehammer. you don't have to ride around half naked on a wrecking ball. And if you do, you'll subsequently regret it. She says that, the music industry doesn't care about you or any of us. They will prostitute you for all you are worth and cleverly make you think it's what you wanted. There was more to it, and I'm sure our panel will want to discuss a little bit of what there was more to it. Miley Cyrus's reaction to that was pretty much pretty negative, and then at one point she took it upon herself to exhibit on the internet a bunch of kind of deranged-sounding tweets that Sinead O'Connor had put out a few years ago when she was, I think, kind of openly having psychiatric problems and kind of trying to figure out on Twitter, which isn't really the right venue for it, how to get help or what to do about it. So it's gone back and forth. And this morning, Sinead O'Connor issued another riposte because Miley had suggested, she was too busy to talk to Sinead or to deal with Sinead O'Connor right now because she's getting ready to host Saturday Night Live. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But maybe they could get together later. Sinead said, I have no interest whatsoever in meeting you. You had plenty of time yesterday to abuse Amanda Bynes, another celebrity with psychiatric problems, an entirely innocent party, and myself, who also did nothing to deserve your abuse. So when you end up in the psych ward or rehab, I'll be happy to visit you, wrote Sinead, and would not lower myself to mock you. Whew, that was quite an exchange. Irene, I don't know. Jump in wherever you want.
Well, I know whose side I'm on.
Okay, whose side are you on?
I'm on Sinead's side. I thought the letter that she wrote was really interesting, and you know, she, you know, the whole idea of the record industry prostituting women for their own gain is true. I think, you know, I believe her, and she's talking out of her own experience. And I never knew that she cut her hair off because someone told her, whether this is true or not, but that's apparently the story, that the reason she has a shaved head is because she was told that, you know, well, you're so beautiful with your long hair, and she was extremely beautiful and with her long hair, and so she said, oh yeah, well, I'm gonna cut it off because I want to have success on my own merits, not on myself as a sex image.
Yeah, I can give you the exact words. So she, in writing to Miley, she said, "You also said in Rolling Stone that your look is based on mine. The look I chose on purpose at a time when my record company were encouraging me to do what you have done. I felt I would rather be judged on my talent, not on my looks. I am happy that I made that choice, not least because I do not find myself on the proverbial rag heap now that I am almost 47 years of age." Carol Costello, by the way, is 51, if anybody really wanted to know.
Anyway. Oh, she looks younger.
See? Now you're doing it. Yeah, anyway, right. Go back to what you were saying.
I think it's so common among young women that they don't understand an older woman trying to look at their experience in any kind of sort of feminist way and advise them in the way that Sinead was trying to advise her. And I think Sinead's motives were very, she wasn't in any kind, there was no hostility or anything. She was just saying, I'm just trying to help you out. But so Miley's reaction seems vicious in a way that I find quite offensive, because she's not only is she not listening to the idea that you're prostituting yourself, she's sort of attacking her for, you know, her own weaknesses, and you know, it's so unfair, you know. And I think a lot of younger women think that older women, well, she must just be jealous of me, you know. They don't understand. They don't understand a lot, you know.
Right. By the way, if you want to chime in on this conversation, if you've been following the Miley Cyrus-Sinead O'Connor exchange that sprawled out over days, I know it was a little eclipsed by the government shutdown. We'll get to that part. But 860-275-7266. We'd love to hear from you. 860-275-7266. Who wants to go next? Heath?
Well, you know, the thing that I thought about when I read through this is I had a hard time at least just trying to figure out what was real and what was not real. What was a product of a public relations consultant's advice to, you know, Miley Cyrus, for example. You know, the O'Connor letter certainly seems very real, seems very much like the voice of experience. You know, somebody that I think the word was used was motherly, and well, I'm not sure if that's the right word to use, but certainly somebody that wanted to give some guidance to what they saw as this young person that was going down a very different path than they'd previously been on. So and then Miley's reaction, of course, was just so immature and catty. It was hard for me to determine whether or not that's actually Miley Cyrus or whether that's somebody that says, ah, here's an opportunity to get a lot of attention and get, you know, a million retweets by putting on this persona. So it was difficult for me to tell, especially in this era where we have, you know, Jimmy Kimmel and Kanye West and, you know, all of these feuds that, you know, are they real? Are they fake? Are they, it's hard to determine what's true and what's false.
They seem to be happening for an audience anyway. There are other ways to conduct a feud.
That's right.
Not so publicly. Rand?
Let me give a two-track response. First, from a parental point of view, and then second, from a cultural...
That's right. You're the father of a young daughter.
Right.
Miley Cyrus, the role model you want.
A cultural feminist point of view in a second set of issues. My daughter's 7, and so she was too young to follow the Miley Cyrus thing, but we were aware of Miley Cyrus. And in as much as I paid attention, the sexualization of her persona in the past couple of years and her incremental movement, you know, toward an adult brand, one that was obviously carefully orchestrated, not primarily necessarily by her. To me, it's been, and to my wife, it's provided sort of in the background this disturbing foreshadowing of, you know, what will come with one's own child. And so to see Miley Cyrus posed in these explicitly sexual images and postures when just a couple of years ago, you know, she was playing happily for the little kids, it is something that, as a parent, you have a visceral reaction against. It seems ominous. And in that context, and I would pick up on what Heath said, the letter that Sinead O'Connor wrote seems, from a parent's point of view, it's like a dream letter for, you know, from a dad. When she says, nothing but harm will come in the long run from allowing yourself to be exploited, and it's absolutely not in any way an empowerment of yourself or any other young woman for you to send the message that you are valued more for your sexual appeal than for your obvious talent. At that point, the dad, you know, I mean, is saying, yeah, absolutely, because she's fighting on behalf of parents against a whole bunch of forces that are out there that are trying to prematurely to sexualize your child. So that's my first response. The second response, which weighs in slightly against it, has to do, well, I immediately then thought of Madonna. I mean, implicit in Sinead's, and I'm not talking now about a specific, her address to a specific child, but the whole project of women in culture, implicit in her letter is the notion that, you know what, you may think that you're the master of your own image or the mistress of your own images, but you're not. This thing, you are going to be exploited and sexualized, and some person on a boat somewhere who's made money off of your sexual humiliation is making three times the amount of money that you've made on it, and you may think that you're in charge of this project, but you're not. You are manipulated by it, and you are humiliated by it. So my question would be, is that necessarily true? What does that say about the evolution in feminism whereby a cultural figure like Madonna can come along and say, yeah, okay, I'm taking all of these tropes and all these images that have been used to degrade women, but I am controlling them, and I'm emerging as the mistress of, you know, of this project.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I wish Madonna would weigh in on this feud. That would be interesting.
That's, you know, what we need. We need her to broker
an accord.
Her.
Yeah, because I do think there is. My first reaction when you said Madonna was, you know, Madonna was different because she really was in charge of herself in a way that Miley Cyrus doesn't seem to be. But maybe that's not true. Maybe that's part of, you know, the way the image worked in terms of Madonna. But she, you know, it was because it was, yeah, she was the driver, definitely.
And I think it's important to see O'Connor's letter in this context. It represents a certain feminist charge that says, no matter, you know, implicitly there's the issue of sort of false consciousness in a way. Obviously, if a child who's 17 or 18 is being, you know, positioned licking sledgehammers and so on, it's obviously grotesque. But and there's the example of Britney Spears and other similar figures who've gone on to have clear life problems that are easy to link to this and that appeal to us into our sympathies. But she's making an implicitly a huge charge about what the limitations of what women think they can do by way of independence and governing their own fates.
I mean, I wonder, first of all, at least one person connected with this show is sending me a message saying, if I were Miley, I wouldn't give a poop about what anyone thinks, and frankly, I didn't ask for advice. I suppose if this were a letter that Frank Sinatra was writing to Mick Jagger, we might see in it a stuffiness a wrongheadedness that we don't see here. But it's an interesting question. I mean, you guys, I think, are homing in on the right question, which is, and it's, I think, an open, unsettled question, is to what degree is Miley Cyrus flying her own plane right now, and to what degree is she, in fact, being exploited? But I also think we have before us some pretty good examples, a few of which I think Sinead, in one or the other of her encyclicals about this, cites, you know. I mean, we've seen Britney Spears kind of go down the tubes exactly this way. We've seen Lindsay Lohan go down the tubes exactly this way. And then, yeah, we've seen Madonna turn it to her own advantage. But I guess that is sort of the question, is if nobody asked for your advice and you proffer it in a public forum like that, I mean, how is somebody like Miley Cyrus supposed to receive it, except as maybe fuel for the fire that she's burning anyway? Let me grab a call here from Craig in Woodbury. Hi, Craig.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Love your show very much.
Thank you.
It's one of the best ones on the radio. My comment is something that you sort of covered just a moment ago, but I think the advice that Sinead O'Connor gave Miley Cyrus is good advice, but I think if she did it out of a pureness of heart, it would have been done privately. The fact that she did it publicly is something that perhaps served to embarrass Miley Cyrus. So as an immature person, you know, she probably then just decided to attack her. And it made it more difficult for Miley Cyrus to take the better advice if she chose to, if she was of a mind to, because it was public. And, you know, that's my comment.
But yeah, thank you so much, Craig. Thanks for your call and for the compliment. But And Heath, that sort of goes back to what you're saying. There's a trope, there's a medium now where people work out, people who are well-known people, work these things out in public forums for reasons that we probably don't entirely grasp. I mean, Sinead O'Connor could have started this whole conversation she's connected enough. She could have reached out to Miley's people. Let's have a conversation about this.
Well, and I think this is one of the fascinating things about modern communication technology is that we're able to send an email or a tweet or post a letter on the internet in such a way that we can communicate our feelings to other people or communicate our views to other people, when in reality, picking up the telephone and making a telephone call, a private conversation, it would be equally, if not more effective in communicating a message, and yet we choose to do things in these more convenient ways, which may or may not ultimately harm the message that we're trying to send. I think it's a great irony of how we communicate, and yet we still do it. We still would prefer to send emails instead of calling someone.
I see Rand getting ready to
Taking up on that and on what the caller said, although it wouldn't be pleasing to Sinead O'Connor to see this way, there is a way in which a letter like this, which was righteous and hectoring and sort of morally rather wintry, adds in a way to her brand in that, you know, she... I mean, there's the irony of the fact that she tried to escape the machine by making herself look unattractive, and oh, that became cool. So there's this way in which her own story testifies to the difficulty once you're in the maw of a certain level of publicity of trying to be authentic, and her letter vibrates with anger and regret. Now, it's not always possible, as we all know. Once we've reached a certain age, you've had hard and bitter experiences. You want to pass the fruits of those experiences on to the next generation. Well, they may have to go through that thing or their own version of it themselves. They're not necessarily going to be deterred by what you are vehemently telling them is important for them to know because you've been there already.
See, you know, Irene, I just want to go to one idea here too, which is that this is an aperçu that just came to me in a flash here on the nose, which is, you know, in a way that Miley's right. They are doing the same thing to a certain degree. I mean, Sinead O'Connor rejected at a certain point any exhortation by anybody that she conformed to some kind of conventional notion of beauty and sexiness and tried to sell her music based on having a certain kind of look. And I think Miley Cyrus has done the same thing. I mean, first of all, I find her current appearance very bizarre. Watching her come out for her famous twerking performance on that award show, she looked very strange. She didn't look attractive at all. I don't think she looks at she's trying to be conventionally attractive. I mean, in a way, I think she's cartoonizing a lot of our ideas about what an attractive woman is. She constantly has her tongue, you know, stuck out to the side, not in a sultry or alluring way, but like some kind of Warner Brothers cartoon. She had this very strange treatment of her hair on this thing. I think she's already doing, you know, in an odd way. I mean, I don't know why she's doing it. I don't know if there's any thought behind it.
This would be like in a Lady Gaga kind of way.
Yeah, or I don't know if that's – maybe that is a good comparison, though. But I wondered if she was – I mean, and it's sort of my way of segueing to this Simon Doonan piece that I circulated. Simon Doonan writes for Slate Magazine wrote this very provocative essay that he wanted to know who the most beautiful woman in the world is, and he rejected emphatically the idea that it's Gwyneth Paltrow because she's trying too hard and all this kind of stuff. But in a way, he's sort of invoking this notion that there are standards of beauty, that there are platonic standards of beauty by which people can be judged. Oh, and they may not be platonic; they may shift with culture, but that they exist somehow. And I don't know. In a way, I think Miley Cyrus. I don't know how to evaluate her current appearance, but it doesn't look like an appearance that's really meant to entice in kind of some conventional Playboy playmate sultry way.
Well, that's what you know. I wonder what men her age say. I don't know, you know, because it seems like there's something about. I mean, boys. There's something about. I think some, you know, people, you know, middle-aged women look at younger women sometimes, and we think it looks like they're trying to look like porn stars, which means that they're doing something for a male gaze that has nothing to do with their own sexuality from inside, any kind of internal sense of who they are sexually. It's more just, I'm supposed to look in this certain way with my G-string or whatever. And it makes us uncomfortable, and and sad because we feel like they're not, you know, they're acting for someone else. And so that's what I felt Sinead was trying to say. I didn't think she was hectoring at all. It seemed to me that, and the reason she did it publicly, yes, I agree that if she really just wanted to tell Miley herself, she could have called her privately. I absolutely agree with that. So it was a statement, but it's a statement to her and all these women who think sexuality equals looking like a porn star. I mean, I don't know, maybe, so... Anyway, that's just what I have to say.
All right. You know what? We'll take a break here. We'll regroup. We'll figure out where we want to go next. This is The Nose. We'll be back. Rand is complaining about benighted modes of discourse.
I don't get it. I don't get that article.
All right. Well, we're moving on anyway. We're going someplace else. This is The Nose, by the way, with us, Heath Folley from the Yankee Policy Institute. From Trinity College is Irene Papoulis. And from his own world is a freelance writer, short story writer, critic, all that kind of stuff is Rand Cooper. So, Rand, we really were sort of stirring around this huge pot of topics today. And we don't know which ones we're actually going to get to. And if you were tuning in to hear us talk about the government shutdown, you may never hear that. But then a lot of other people are talking about the government shutdown. Instead, Rand at the last minute sent us this piece today. It's actually, first of all, it started as an article in Details magazine. It's moved over to the New York Times, where they have kind of a discussion forum where they've brought in five or six writers, most of them pretty young writers, I think, to write very, very short essays and solicit reader comments on the whole notion of what happens when a man dresses too young for his age. Let me read the beginning of it because it does sort
of link. It's a great beginning.
It does sort of link back a little bit, if I have the right piece. Yeah, I do. It does link back a little bit to the conversation we just had. Yeah. It's an uncomfortable realization. The woman walking toward you, who at a distance is in her with her mid-thigh skirt and swan-diving V-neck, appeared to be 25, turns out to be 25 years older than that. It's Carol Costello. No. Yikes, you think. Such desperation. The world's a minefield for women over 40 trying to dress youthfully. Then you think, thanks again, Y chromosome, for one less thing to fret over. But allow us to puncture that sense of security. Recently, as we've noted in these pages, men have shown themselves to be just as eager as the fairer sex to cling to the vestments of their youth or to co-opt the vestments of today's youth. And in ever more misbegotten ways, we now have a small army of male archetypes suffering sartorial midlife crises. I'll just do one more paragraph here. There's the man still padding around dressed like the 28-year-old Silver Lake hipster, Vans, Daft Punk t-shirt, thigh-hugging jeans he was a decade ago. His proliferation is easy to understand because his style requires no effort. Changed nothing. No wonder he was numerous stuck-in-time siblings. He has numerous stuck-in-time siblings like his urban-styled brethren. Let me just, before I open up the floor to discussion, say that Heath is wearing a very conservative suit. And Rand is wearing a Gumby t-shirt. That's actually the truth. So, Rand, as you kicked this over to us, what were you thinking about? Where did you want to go?
In part, it was one of those articles where I suddenly thought that I was being pinged, you know, and hadn't really thought that much about it. And then I realized that I was wearing shorts, a Gumby t-shirt, and high-top Converse sneakers, and I'm 54 years old. And I thought, oh no, I'm one of these hapless guys that they're mocking in this article. So that's how it began. And then I also thought, well, how often it's the case when I go to New York and we're visiting friends in Brooklyn, you know, that I see various iterations of the types that they're taking down a peg here. And seems like there's a whole bunch of middle-aged guys, often with little kids, and the guys are dressed like they're 14 and they're pushing their strollers around. And I suddenly thought, well, what is this all about? And this piece seemed to be landing on some of it. And having fun with it.
By the way, if you want to be part of this conversation, 860-275-7266. You may notice it's the same phone number, 860-275-7266. This is 266. Irene, take it away.
I can't help but think of Deborah Tannen's work on unmarked women. This was maybe, you know, I don't know, a couple of decades ago, or and she talked about how men could wear whatever they wanted and not be marked, you know, or if in the business world, men would just wear a suit and they wouldn't have to be marked, whereas whatever women put on marked them in a certain way. So now that the progress that we've made is now men are marked too, you know, that women, you know, now men too can't wear anything without feeling like it's making some kind of statement whether they want to or not.
So, unpack the word marked for us a little bit more.
Oh, yeah, marked meaning that someone can translate what you're wearing into some kind of information about you that you may or may not want. So what she meant was, you know, if a woman, how's a woman going to dress? You know, you can't wear a neutral. You can't be neutral. You're going to be trying to be sexy. If you look sexy, if you dress one way, or trying to be, you know, too matronly another way, et cetera. And she has this whole taxonomy of the different ways that women are marked by whatever they have on. And so there's no such thing as a neutral outfit. But now, you know, a man can't just put on a T-shirt if he wants to go out. He has to, you know, but what can he put on? You know, maybe men can't do it either. So there's that reaction. But I also have the reaction that, you know, who says that it's, you know, that a T-shirt is only for 12-year-olds? You know, can't you say it's, you know, that's what a 50-something-year-old guy might want to wear?
Well, it depends on the T-shirt. So do you think Heath is marked by his sartorial choice today?
He's marked with a certain, with elegance. Yeah, he looks like an elegant dresser. Yeah.
He looks great. And look, I do love wearing a suit. I don't do it very often. But, you know, one of the functions of clothing is to send a set of signals, in a way, and that's long been obviously work dominated. What we wear when we work is in essence our uniform. And in some ways, when you have the experience of watching, as I'll watch later on today, Boston Red Sox play, and you see the managers, you know, these 55-year-old men in these pajama like eternal child costumes of eternal childhood, you think, you know, how silly it is. You have these moments where you think how silly it is that this 60-year-old guy is wearing a baseball uniform. But in a way, a society organizes itself and gives off signals by giving everyone a kind of uniform. And it's interesting. I know that you're making an argument, Irene, for, you know, our freedom to do what we want, why we want, and how we want to. But we all do wear a certain kind of uniform, and it gives off a signal whether we want to acknowledge that, you know, or not.
Well, you know, Heath, I want to hear all your response to everything that everybody just said, but I want to throw in one last thing there, too. I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, I think the only people ever to be on the nose and wearing a suit, and I could be wrong, are you and Kevin Rennie, who are both Republicans. and I'm wondering, too, whether there's also a political component to that, that, like, you know, to what we're talking about here, that sure. That those guys that Rand sees pushing strollers and dressed like 14-year-olds probably aren't Republicans.
Well, you never know. No, I mean, I think that Rand is right that everything that we do in our lives send signals to other people about who we are. Often those signals, and we get to tailor those signals just as we change our clothes. So, you know, if you want to wear, you know, cowboy boots, that sends one message. If you want to, you know, if you want to wear a T-shirt, that sends another message. So I actually would connect it to our previous discussion. You know, the clothing that Miley Cyrus wears when she's on a wrecking ball, you know, boots, and that's about it. you know, that sends a message. That sends a message about, you know, either who she is or who her publicist wants her to be, that kind of thing. So I think that's and I think that's the question raised in the article is what is this message that people are sending, and, you know, trying to decode that message.
And the answer to that is simple, according to this article. The message is, I'm not as old as you might think I am. I am young. I'm staying young. The writer says, men have increasingly wanted to put up some walls between themselves and time, or themselves and the years. In this sense, one of the points of this piece is to put men, locate them, in increasingly in the same predicament that has bedeviled and enmeshed women vis-a-vis age. And I think it's clear that there's much more that men are facing aging somewhat differently from the way they did 30 or 40 years ago, and that they are finding themselves facing some of the predicaments that were formerly associated with women.
I think that, and I'm going to throw this to Irene in just a second, but I'll just add two little facets to that. One of them is, I think we all dress to a certain degree aspirationally, and my son has been pointing out to me recently, my son who just turned 24 on Tuesday has been pointing out to me recently that he owns a suit and I don't. And I think in a lot of I literally don't have a suit. This, whenever we go to a wedding or something like that, this comes up. But
so what do you do? You don't wear a a suit? You just
sort of,
he just offends people right and left.
What I say to my son is I've reached a point in life where my eccentricities are so well spelled out that nobody really sort of expects too much from me. But I think we also – but I think Rand is really right about this, that we dress aspirationally and that the rules for men are changing a little bit. And I do think that there's an economic component to this, you know, that in all the ways that Atlantic Magazine has done such a good job of chronicling, men are worth less on the job market than they used to be. Women are more employable than men in a lot of different ways. And so maybe that whole idea used to be that men didn't have to sort of worry so much. Not that they didn't sometimes. You could easily find a picture of some guy in 1969 who's 69 years old, and he's wearing bell bottoms, and his hair's too long, and he's got just some. I mean, this has always happened, but there may be a little bit more of that pressure right now because, you know, it used to be in the old paradigm that men could get older and more distinguished and didn't really have to worry too much about that because they were also so much about their resources. Well, maybe men aren't worth so much economically now. Maybe they have to be cuter one way or another. Maybe they're trying to be cuter, but that seems like a populist.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do. It does. It's poor men, right? We feel sorry for them, for you. But it's true. More men dye their hair maybe as they get older than they used to in the 60s. Like, it's, you know, there's a different standards that women have when they look at men in terms of how they're dressed, et cetera. But I don't know. What I'm thinking about, too, right now, though, is the idea of snarkiness, you know, that sort of looking at a man you don't even know and saying, oh, my gosh, can you believe what he's wearing? You know, that is so inappropriate. And I think I used to do that also with women. You know, when I was younger, I would look at older women who were wearing, you know, leather pants or whatever and think, oh, my gosh, she's just trying to be. And I would make fun of her viciously, you know, maybe with my friends. But now that I'm older, I think, you know, so she felt like wearing a pair of leather pants, you know, so he wanted to wear a T-shirt. It just feels so unfair to be so critical and snarky when you for no other reason than just that you think you're superior in some way, or you're seeing something, or you're seeing through something that the man himself isn't seeing through. You know, that's just not fair.
A great place to turn to if you want an inside account of the kind of age-related desperation men can feel is the novels of Tom Wolfe. And Tom Wolfe hits on this theme again and again and again, the aging alpha male, and who walks around jutting his chin out because he's concerned about the turkey waddle that has developed. There are whole characters who spend seemingly much of their days trying to orchestrate an impression of youthful virility when they're beyond that. And I associate those books, which started coming out in the 1980s and early 90s.
Betsy Kaplan is chiming in with John Updike, too, does this well. The aging,
but Updike does it in the Rabbit books with the he places the dread fear of mortality and uses it for differently from the way Wolfe does, because Wolfe writes about vanity and status, and all these insecurities go directly back to the male status in the world, whereas with Updike, in my view, it becomes more of a metaphysical problem.
All right, let me grab a couple calls here. Let's start with Sally in Sandy Hook. Hi, Sally.
Oh, hi. I'm a 63-year-old woman, and I've been wearing, like, Ghostbuster T-shirts and weird T-shirts, and I wear them out a lot, and I've been doing it for quite a few years. And one time about 5 years ago, I asked my pastor if maybe I should grow up a little, and he said, no. So I decided to keep doing it because I really get a positive response from people. I mean, there might be some people that are kind of secretly laughing, but a lot of people seem to really just, the young people in particular really respond, and I engage in conversation with them and stuff about stuff. And
you know, what I'm hearing in you, Sally, too, is, and maybe it's a thing that we haven't said so far today, but I think it's sort of there in all those essays that we read, is that idea of making it your own, whatever it is that you're doing. If it feels like you're putting it on, you know, to get a certain response or because you think you should have done it. Right, Heath, it's sort of authenticity. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, it's a control issue. If you are taking ownership of it, if you are in charge of your career or your dress or you know, whatever other factor you're talking about, then it's one thing. But if it's a put on, if it's faked, then it seems quite different.
Right. So we should all be more like Madonna. In that respect.
Kevin tweets, the day utilitarian clothing such as T-shirts, jeans, and shorts aren't appropriate is the day I quit clothing altogether. Well, that'll be an interesting day. And we've got one more call here. This is Tom in Simsbury. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Colin. Very interesting topic here. I remember not too long ago hearing a clothing merchandiser or retailer being interviewed on a show somewhere. And he claimed that one of the challenges that that industry has is that statistically, men stop buying clothes in their early to mid-50s. And they're trying to figure out how to reverse that, how to change that. And I'm 54, and I absolutely fall into that. I rarely buy clothes.
So you wear the same things that you've always – the same clothes, you mean?
Until your wife says you can't wear that anymore.
Well, I feel like I've got enough clothes. I feel like I just don't need to buy anymore. I think that the point is that the motivation just doesn't seem to be there.
All right. No wonder we can't climb out of 2008. Nobody's this whole cohort of baby boomers is refusing to buy any more clothes. Well, I do think some of this is, though, and particularly in the case of the baby boom generation, we were the generation who decided we weren't going to have to entirely grow up or get really old or die. I mean, that's basically the plan that the baby boomers have, right? We're not going to. And so it's small wonder that we're wearing Gumby T-shirts.
But there also has been a great diversification in corporate styles and in the corporate uniform. And if you look at the most creative ranks of corporate America, and there are whole companies where you would never dress natty as he is. You would never dress the way Heath is dressed right now. So go out, to Silicon Valley, and I mean, you've got CEOs who are 33 years old, and they're wearing shorts and a T-shirt. So there has been a radical transformation even in corporate styles.
Which goes back to the question. You didn't really answer that question, though. I mean, do you think there is sort of a political component to it? I mean, Republican men dress better or sharper or something like that than Democrats do. I mean, you could just walk into the state capitol and see that, can't you?
I don't think so. I think if you walk through the capitol, I think you'll see there's a number of very sharply dressed Democrats up there. So I don't think that's
all right. You reject that proposal. All right. I'll tell you what. We'll take a little break. We'll come back mainly with endorsements. We've got a whole bunch of other things on our list to talk about, but I'm trying to manage the clock so we get everything done here.
So what would be a happy ending? The government reopens and Miley and Sinead and Britney perform together in front of the Washington Monument and nobody licks a sledgehammer? Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our interns, Corey Breen and Greg Dyson. Voiceover help in the intro by Greg Hill. The part of Bill Curry was played by Kevin Federline. On Monday, third parties battling their way onto municipal ballots. And now, back to Colin.
As is so often the case here at The Nose, there was a really interesting conversation going on during the break, but we can't recreate it for you. We're going to go to endorsements right now. If we have any time towards the end, we might be able to circle back to one of these fascinating topics. But we're going to start with endorsements. Since Heath is new, he can go last, so he can hear the experts do an endorsement. We'll start over here with Rand.
I like going out to breakfast, and so I'm just going to endorse two breakfast places. One I've mentioned before, it's the Spicy Green Bean in Glastonbury. It's on Hebron Avenue, and they serve terrific breakfasts, and it's a funky, fun place. I also would recommend
drive all the way to Glastonbury just to have breakfast?
Sure.
Yeah.
Bring family, friends, and newspapers, and people sometimes wear their pajamas at this place. It's
what
cool.
Do they have there that's so great for breakfast?
They have like breakfast burritos, that kind of thing, and with all sorts of side dishes, and it's a little bit upscale and funky and cool. Now, for just your basic diner, I go with my daughter all the time to Town Line Diner. It's in Rocky Hill on the Silas Dean Highway, and this is your basic Greek diner, big breakfast, bacon, eggs, pancakes, terrific French toast. They also have really good dinners there, by the way. They have really good moussaka. Nothing fancy in this diner at all. Extremely friendly service. The last thing I'm going to endorse is tonight we are going up to the Iron Horse to hear singer-songwriter and Colin McEnroe show veteran Jill Sobule. And they usually have tickets still available. We love the Iron Horse. It's sort of dinner theater concept, so you can go and get something to eat and drink and sit really close to the stage. And Jill Sobule is a funny, quirky, ironic singer-songwriter of the 80s and 90s and even now.
Too. She's amazing. Jill Sobule is great. I had the honor of introducing her and Julia Sweeney, bringing them out on stage at the Mark Twain House recently. But I've seen her perform live a few times. She's great. I wish I were going, but I'm doing something else fun. Yeah, go ahead.
I have never been to a fashion show, and I don't usually go to benefits that cost $75. But on October 19th, I'm going to a benefit that costs $75 for the Connecticut AIDS Coalition. It's going to be this elaborate fashion show that's also going to include food and wine to drink. And Colin McEnroe is one of the judges.
I will not be dressed appropriately, as has now been made clear on this show.
That's quite ironic. Colin is a fashion judge, given what was disclosed.
Yeah, and this guy, Mondo Guerra, who apparently everyone thinks has heard of, except me. Something about Project Runway. I don't know. It's a TV show. And he's going to be there. And they're going to have local boutiques having fashion shows of their clothes. But then there's going to be some kind of contest where people have to design some fashion in half an hour or something. And Colin is going to be one of the people judging that. And it's going to be a great party. And it's October 19th. And you can go to the Connecticut AIDS Coalition to find the rest of the information.
I can get up to speed on this kind of thing in a couple of weeks. Believe me, it's not that hard. You can learn anything in a couple of weeks. Heath, what would you like to endorse?
And for my endorsement, I'm going to do Pumpkin Town in East Hampton, Connecticut, the purveyors of Paul's and Sandy's Hardware and Garden Center. Every fall about this time, host Pumpkin Town. They dress up scarecrows with pumpkin heads, and they've built out an entire pumpkin town, pumpkintown.com. You can find it online, where there's a Mac Pumpkins and a whole array of other assorted fun things for the kids to do, hay rides, etc. It costs $4. One of those $4, 25% of the proceeds goes to benefit the Sandy Brzezinski Breast Cancer Fund. So well worth the trip out to East Hampton down Route 66 to Paul's and Sandy's for Pumpkin Town.
All right. In that vein, I was asked to also endorse or announce anyway that tonight is Achieve Hartford's 7th Annual Community Spelling Bee. A little point of history. Irene, Rand, and I were, I think, a team. Well, I think we were the entire team 1 year in that, and we lost because of me. I'll just get it right out there because Rand has never let me forget it, and rightfully so. Anyway, it's at the Theater of Performing Arts. That's on 359 Washington Street in Hartford. That's the part of the Learning Corridor there. It starts at 6:30 tonight. Two people connected with this show are involved. Our very own Irene Papoulis will be the official word pronouncer. What kind of training do you have for that? I mean, you just like look in the dictionary.
I trained her.
Rand trained me.
Words of pronouncing things correct. Years of pronouncing things correctly is your training. Because I noticed now that the pronunciations that they have, like on Wikipedia or something, are used some other whole phonetic system that I'm not familiar with. It's not the one from the dictionary that I grew. It's some international phonetic system that I never understand.
Uh-oh.
Not to scare you or anything. But anyway, and Wolfie will be one of the judges. So there you go. I'm going to endorse two things. One of them is Margaret Sullivan, who's the public editor of the New York Times. Now, many people have held this position since they started it. They rotate people in and out every few years. I don't think anybody's ever been as feisty and combative with the New York Times as Margaret Sullivan. She's not incidentally, I believe, the first woman to hold this job. And so just watching what she does, and she's right now in a real battle with the paper about a headline and about an article and about over-reliance on anonymous sources and on, and she just goes at it with them in a way that's, I think it's really healthy, too. I like the New York Times. I subscribe to the New York Times. I have it delivered to my house, old school. But I love the idea that they are constantly being challenged. And she, more than anybody who's done this job, is really taking it seriously and really going to the mat with them on some other stuff.
Couldn't the city of Hartford get an ombudsman like who would do that?
Just to monitor the city-owned cars and stuff like that?
Everything.
They need one. But anyway, the final thing I'm going to endorse is a good garbage cans, good trash cans. And Elizabeth Park at one point had one really good trash can, and they noticed they've been adding a couple more. And so they're sort of nice-looking trash cans, so you kind of want to use them, you know, and they sort of close up so that things don't blow out of them. And I have this whole theory that there aren't enough trash cans, aren't enough garbage cans, generally speaking, and that particularly in places where people walk. And I say this as a dog owner because, I'm willing to pick up my dog's poop in a plastic bag, but I don't want to carry it for a mile and a half. You know, I want a garbage can to come up really soon for me to dump it in. So I'm urging anybody who has any control over garbage cans, get really good ones so people will use them and get lots of them. What an incredibly uplifting note to end on. All right, thanks to Heath, thanks to Irene, thanks to Rand. We'll be back on Monday.
I'm Kyon Wolf, and it is pretty nice up here. I can see the whole planet. I can see a lot of the universe. I can sing a song as loud as I want. Nobody cares. Here comes the sun. Oh, my God, here comes the sun.